This week on Behind the Lens, we're closing out the year with recaps of some of our top stories, including the Entergy astroturfing scandal and the story of a special needs student. The system struggled to accommodate him. His mother refused to give up.
Definitely advocate for your child's needs and what your child specifically needs in that classroom to succeed. Because if not, I think special needs kids just kind of get lost in the shuffle.
We'll have an update on this bittersweet story. Also, where do nonprofits such as The Lens fit in today's fragmented media landscape? I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
As we wrap up 2018, some questions about one of our most widely read investigations will have to wait until next year. We're talking about Entergy New Orleans' controversial public relations campaign in support of a proposed power plant in the East. Michael Isaacstein recaps his reporting on the so-called astroturfing scandal.
So the investigation actually began, you know, over 6 months before we actually published the story. For one of my first assignments from The Lens, actually, I was sent to cover a city council hearing on the proposed power plant. And at the time, what we were focused on is what the critics were saying, which was that Entergy, through two separate applications, had yet to establish some actual need for this power plant. They were also talking about the generous incentives they were getting from the city to build it. At that meeting, you know, we expected to hear a lot from the opposition. But what was strange is that, you know, we saw this group of 50, 60, 70 people in orange shirts who were there to support it. And I had tried to talk to a lot of these people to figure out, you know, why they had shown up, what group they were part of, and really no one would talk to me. And everyone kept pointing me to this guy, Dan, who eventually we found out worked for this company called Crowds on Demand out of L.A. But that was the first time we interviewed them. At the time, they told us that they were, I think it was the Council for Responsible Governance. And, you know, that was the first time we kind of felt that something was fishy, although we did not have enough at the time to make any serious kind of allegation. And things kind of moved forward. WWL, to their credit, were the first to get someone on the record saying they had been paid. So that kind of re-sparked our interest in this. And that's when I got an email from Daniel Tate. Daniel Tate was really instrumental to all this coming out. And Kevin Litton with NOLA.com does a great profile of him if you want to find out more about him. So Daniel emailed me and we had met before, and I told him I was interested in the story. And he said, you know, one of my friends actually was in those orange shirts and he was paid. So that was kind of our road into this story that kind of just exploded from there. Once you talk to the first person, leads to the second, leads to the third, and so on.
Right. How difficult was it to really pin this paid actors astroturfing campaign to Crowds on Demand and eventually the Hawthorne Group, the PR firm that hired Crowds on Demand?
Yeah. So Crowds on Demand, in our first story, I mean, we weren't 100% sure it was Crowds on Demand. It had been mentioned in one of the Facebook messages that we saw. And since the company so perfectly fit the profile of what was happening in New Orleans, you know, we thought it was worth mentioning. Hawthorne hadn't come up at the time. And you know, it was still – I mean, Entergy had been careful through this. So it was it wasn't easy to draw a connect line directly to Entergy or Hawthorne or Crowds on Demand. It really wasn't until the city council launched its investigation and demanded Entergy hand over all these documents that things started to really clarify.
Right. And Entergy's story to that point was what exactly? I mean, they were not forthcoming whatsoever, were they, as far as?
Right. So you know, I think maybe a week after our initial story, which was in the beginning of May, they released the results of their own internal investigation that said, yes, Crowds on Demand, a company in LA, did hire people, including some professional actors, to come to city council meetings and support Entergy's proposed power plant. But what they were claiming was that it was done through one of their contractors. So they had hired a PR firm called the Hawthorne Group, who has actually had a history of this kind of sort of deceptive campaigning before. And yeah, basically their claim was that they never authorized Hawthorne to do this, that Hawthorne did this on their own. And actually now Entergy is actually suing Hawthorne, you know, over this claimed deception. Mm-hmm.
But of course, later developments in this investigation uncovered that Entergy had a fairly good idea of exactly what was going on.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, then after the documents came out, we reported, you know, showing basically all these different messages where top people in Entergy were, you know, talking about the specific numbers of people they wanted, the specific number of speakers and paying PR firms to write speeches and, you know, what color should the shirt say be? What should they say? So, right. So they were really involved in the details of this and, you know, that was confirmed, you know, when the results of the city council investigation came out, the independent investigation that found that Entergy either knew or should have known that this scheme was going on.
It reminds me of the what you refer to as the infamous "this is a war" text,
right,
from Entergy's CEO at the time,
yeah,
Charles Rice, and a gentleman who is no longer CEO of that utility.
Yeah, and I think the reason why that quote got so big, I mean, I think it's indicative of the larger campaign that was fought over this plant. I mean, because it wasn't just the paid actors. Like we've reported on, they called on their charitable, beneficiaries to come testify for them. They cut off funding for the radio station WBOK because of unfavorable coverage of the news story. And, you know, a lot of their practices just weren't forthright. I mean, outside of the paid actors, which was obviously the most explicit example of astroturfing, but there were still a lot of examples where you saw that the mindset wasn't so much engaging the community here as much as countering community opposition.
Yeah. Offer a little detail, if you will, about some of your findings regarding some city politicians and how they are linked in Entergy's campaign.
One of the reports we came out with after the first documents came out was about connections between Entergy's campaign and you know, high-powered politicians in the city, for lack of a better phrase. You know, the one that we had highlighted was Sydney Nguyen's nonprofit, Viet, who had done translation services for Entergy. And the reason why we highlighted that is a month before she had been asked publicly if she had any business dealings with Entergy, and she had said no. The other one, the other two instances of this kind of crossover were two of Mayor Cantrell's, you know, top officials in her campaign, Bill Roussel, who was her chief strategist, and Bob Tucker, who served on her mayoral transition team. And both of those men run PR firms that were hired by Entergy for this campaign to pass the power plant. One of the things that Bob Tucker billed Entergy for was actually setting up a meeting between Entergy officials and Mayor Cantrell. I think the point of this reporting wasn't so much to say that there was anything explicitly nefarious in any of these things. I think the larger point is that it is a small town, New Orleans, and there is a lot of crossover between peoples of power in various positions. You know, just kind of highlighting that there is kind of this small club of people who, have a large say over public matters.
Mm-hmm. It seems this story really has offered a case in point for how business is done in city government and with regard to big players like utilities such as Entergy.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it also shows how business is done, you know, in the utility industry. I've talked a lot with Logan Burke at the Alliance for Affordable Energy. And something that she always hits on is that, you know, over the past 10, 20 years, the utility industry has changed enormously. Demand isn't rising like it used to. You know, I think everybody is shocked over how quickly renewables have become a viable option. But yet most of the incentives that regulators like the city council offer these utilities is for them to continue to build more generation. Regulations that were set up in times where every year energy demand was growing by 10%. So the business model of Entergy is to continue to build big things. They get an 11% return on their capital investments, which means on this $211 million power plant, they would get a $23 million profit just for building it. Meanwhile, you know, the profit, the cost of construction, the fuel, the staffing, all of that would be passed on to ratepayers' bills. So I think it kind of shows how the older utility business model may not be matching up in an age where energy is becoming more of a democratic conversation.
Let's talk about what developments we need to watch out for in the year ahead on this front. A lot of moving parts still to keep an eye on.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, off the bat, everyone's suing everyone. no, I mean, there are a number of lawsuits going on right now. The group, a coalition of environmental and energy consumer advocates, you know, the coalition that was the main opposition to this power plant in the first place, they have launched two separate lawsuits against the city council that have to do with this plant and the astroturfing campaign. One is an open meetings violation complaint, basically saying that since Entergy paid people to go to meetings and get there early, that they were locked out of a meeting that they should have been allowed into. The other focuses on a conflict of interest between Dentons, who the city, you know, pays roughly $7 million a year to be our utility advisors. They have played a lot of roles in this entire kind of hearing process for the power plant. And basically what the lawsuit is saying is that, yeah, they had conflict of interest in all these different roles. Like I said before, Entergy is now suing Hawthorne because Entergy is still claiming that they did not know anything about the astroturfing campaign. That same coalition I mentioned before, they have sent a complaint to the Treasury Department asking them to audit and investigate the Entergy Charitable Foundation for how they may have directed their beneficiaries to lobby for their for-profit projects. But probably the biggest thing to look out for is that at the end of this investigation, City Council is now considering a $5 million fine on Entergy. We'll know that by the end of the year. But the other big thing that came out after the investigation was that two city council members, Jason Williams and Jared Brossette, said they would be open to a revote. And you know, it's significant that it's Brossette and Williams because those are the only two members of the current council that were also on the previous council when they actually approved this power plant back in May. Both of them voted yes at the time. And I think we'll probably find out about that before the end of the year as well. But those are the big things to watch.
Currently, there is no planned revote, but it is a possibility.
It's a possibility. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a super strong one, but, you know, in the past couple of months, for the first time since they voted yes in May, we are getting indications that there's at least a willingness to do so.
Michael, this was a $1.3 million public relations campaign by Entergy, paid actors and all. And at the end of the day, barring a potential revote, they will get their plant in New Orleans East. Are we left to consider this sort of strategy a winning strategy by Entergy?
I think that's a really good question. I think when you're talking about this type of strategy, I mean, I think it would surprise me if we saw more paid actors at city council meetings from Entergy. But I think there's another kind of simpler astroturfing technique that is widely used across the country, which is, you know, setting up these groups with names like the Alliance for Reasonable Energy, the Alliance for Sustainable Energy, whatever it is, that is really created by these utility companies. And those have been successful not exactly at convincing people, but at least confusing the conversation. So if there is consistent, ubiquitous opposition from the community, that can get distorted to look like, okay, there are some people that oppose it, there's some people that like it. So it can confuse the conversation. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the big question here is, you know, you say like, is it worth the risk? Because if they hadn't got caught, there would be no problem. But even, you know, they did get caught. And you know, this $5 million fine is massive in terms of what city council has levied in the past. But like we talked about before, they're guaranteed a $23 million profit off of the construction of this plant. So at the end of the day, you know, if they're netting $17 million, I mean, I'm not an economist, I'm not a businessman, but I think that there's an argument that it was still worth it in the end.
Michael Isaacstein, thank you very much for doing great work on this investigation, and we'll trust you to continue keeping an eye on this.
Will do. Thanks, Tom.
We are very proud of our education reporting at The Lens and of our education reporter, Marta Juice, and we spoke with her Wednesday to recap two of her biggest stories of 2018, including the saga of Harney Academy.
Harney was always a school that we'd paid a little bit of attention to because they had a few documents submitted late a couple years in a row. So something, you know, that's kind of on the back of our minds, but a lot that happens at a lot of schools. A year ago, we noticed that they had been flagged in an audit for some, you know, missing paperwork that, in addition to being flagged for these late documents submitted to the state, that they had also been referred to the ethics board for this potentially unethical contract where the chief financial officer was also working for the school as an accountant.
Just looking at some of the reports you have filed on this particular story, you reported on the board president charging $1,500 in fine dining on the school's credit card. The school had withheld employees' retirement funds for several months. Certainly a situation that deserved quite a bit of attention. But how does this case play into the broader effort by Orleans Parish School District in terms of the reunification effort, bringing schools back under that umbrella from the recovery school district, for instance?
When we look at Orleans Parish now, I really see it more as a system of schools rather than a school system, if that makes sense. Harney being one of the schools and having its own independent board as part of that big, you know, network of schools. This is all something that the school district has to keep a close watch on. So what we found in these audits were that there were missing credit card reimbursement forms. There was other missing paperwork. There was a failure to separate duties in the finance office, and just kind of a bunch of little financial irregularities that with some digging and records requests, we realized were really symptomatic of maybe some bigger issues, including, like you talked about, Harney withholding tens of thousands of dollars from employees' retirement accounts. We also later found out that money was being put, or the state per pupil funding was being put into a board account, and the only person who had access to that account was board president, Reverend Charles Southall, and he was the only person who could transfer money to the school account. Meanwhile, the school account is having trouble paying bills and keeping the school afloat. And, you know, really, we're the ones who kind of dug in and analyzed these bank statements and reported this, which has all recently been confirmed by an Orleans Parish forensic audit. So I think in terms of reunification in a very long roundabout way is that each of these schools are very uniquely complicated and in depth. And this is really a question of, the district's ability to monitor them, at an individual and in-depth level.
Should we expect the parish school district to be a better, more capable watchdog of these sort of activities at the school level than the individual schools themselves?
The district certainly has a duty to keep a close eye on schools and make sure that they're fulfilling their contracts. I think we've already seen the district step up a little bit. Obviously, we saw that they wanted to revoke Kearney's charter mid-year. Now that the district has, you know, 80 schools under its purview, that is really going to be a lot of work for them to set up these systems to catch issues like Kearney. And we hear a lot about accountability in charter schools, and so to have accountability, we need someone to enforce and hold the schools accountable.
Okay. And among the multitude of education stories that you have reported on in the last year, there is Brady's Room. Summarize that, recap that story, remind some of our readers of this very particular and sad situation.
Brady LaFleur is a 14-year-old boy who has autism, Down syndrome, and anxiety issues, and he is an Orleans Parish student. His mom contacted me in early February when she learned that McDonough 35 was going to be closing because that's the school she had always planned to send Brady to. And it's where she felt comfortable with him and where she had actually just finally found a space where he was doing well. That's hence the name Brady's Room for the story. It was a specially designed room outfitted for about $130,000 for a different boy with high needs. And Brady eventually ended up using it, and then he was all going to be taken away from him very suddenly because he had to go into high school, which in this district would be a charter school. We reported that story as the school year was ending, and as Brady's mom was looking for a new high school, which basically on her checklist, you know, was safety for Brady. He had to be on a first floor classroom for safety reasons, and she was having a really hard time narrowing that down. This really showed how a parent of a special education student could have trouble navigating a system as she went from school to school trying to find the right and safe school for Brady. At the same time, whatever she put down on the one app, she was going to have to hope that he got his first choice in the lottery.
And you have interviewed Brady LaFleur's mother for an update on that story. Here is that interview.
When I was informed that McDonough 35 was, they were closing the school down and turning it into a tech college, I was really upset and disappointed because we had finally found a room that was Brady was making progress in. We had less instances of increased anxiety and unwillingness to go to school, and you know, there were days where when he did not want to go to school. When he started using that room, he actually asked to go to school. So that's how I knew he was comfortable in the room that he was using at the old McDonough 35. And I couldn't understand why they would undo a classroom that was just fixed up the year before for a student that was similar to Brady and had his kind of issues that Brady had, and not let us stay in the room and utilize the space when they turned it into, when they were going to turn it into the community tech college. I couldn't understand why that wasn't possible. Brady was at Pinecrest, which is a residential facility for individuals with developmental disabilities. He was there for about 5 months, and the team had scheduled a transition to home meeting, and it was actually held at the old McDonough 35 school, and someone from the RSD was there. We had several people from like mental health, school, what else? Just different like entities, somebody from a Metropolitan Human Service District, which we use for Brady. We were all in the meeting, and a representative from RSD said when school came up, they asked what we were going to do for school for him, and I told them I really didn't know that he was making significant progress at the school at Pinecrest because it's a special school district and it only has special needs kids in in that school, and I was hoping to try to get something similar for Brady, which they advised me they didn't have. But they had a room that another student was using that had issues, kind of like Brady. And they asked if I knew about it. I said no. And I said, well, after the meeting, is there any way that we can kind of go tour the classroom and see if it would be a good fit for Brady and if even we could use it? And so I got to see the room, and that's when I contacted Orleans Parish and asked them if we could use the space after after Brady came home and wasn't making progress at Hines where he was. That's when I asked them about the room and asked them if we could use it because he was put on homebound services. I like the room because you enter directly from outside and it goes straight into the classroom. It's the lab. It's the first room of I guess the end of the catwalk. And you walk directly in, and it's a big open space. It had a full kitchen, a full bath. It had a sensory room. It had a padded room in the same, you know, in the same room. And they had little furniture in there. Whatever furniture was in there was bolted to the ground. And it was just a nice open space for, you know, a child with behavior challenges. Like my son. Brady was enrolled at Morris Jeff High School, and because they are sharing a building with Clark High School, we had to find a space for Brady to use because they had asked us to leave all McDonough 35 High School. So Orleans Parish and Morris Jeff got together. They searched for a room. They found one at the new McDonough 35 high school, but just as I predicted, it didn't work out. He had to navigate halls to get to the classroom. The bathroom was not inside the classroom. They had to navigate halls to go get to the bathroom. So he is back on homebound services. And after much hard work and pleading with Orleans Parish and asking them to find either a similar setup like the old McDonough 35 or to put us back at the old McDonough 35 because Lafayette Academy is now utilizing that old McDonough 35 to either put us back there or find something that duplicates it. When I found out Lafayette Academy was using it, I kind of wrote an email and said, you know, there's no reason why Brady can't be using that building, I mean that room, until, you know, they figure out what's going on with Lafayette Academy. And they agreed to let him back in the room, and he's going to start on January 3rd. So what I would tell parents if you have a child that's entering high school is do your research on the high schools, definitely tour them. Because navigating the charter school system is very challenging. My big thing was to ask questions and definitely tell them what you're looking for specifically and to fight for your child's needs because they will try to tell you what they think is best for your child in the charter school system and you really know what's best, not them. But definitely advocate for your child's needs and what your child specifically needs in that classroom to succeed. Because if not, I think special needs kids just kind of get lost in the shuffle and just kind of pushed around and not truly given what they really need.
Part of special education law requires that a student be put in their least restrictive environment where they can make progress in the curriculum. And I know that's a lot of education jargon, but for Brady, it was that bright blue colored room with a lot of productive toys and a good teacher. And after having trouble in his new setting, we're happy to report that he's back in that specialized classroom. Brady's case is certainly one of the more extreme cases of, you know, showing how hard it can be to find a perfect classroom for a student. But every student in this parish is entitled to an education, so it's still very important that we tell his story.
Marta Jewson, wrapping up a very busy year in education news for The Lens. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We wanted to take a few minutes this week to discuss what it means to be a nonprofit newsroom and where The Lens fits in New Orleans news media. For that, we spoke with Karen Gabois, co-founder of The Lens, and Steve Myers. Steve is currently on leave from The Lens to attend a journalism fellowship with the Nieman Foundation.
Well, I'm spending the year at Harvard looking into how nonprofit news sites like The Lens can demonstrate value to readers and get readers to support the work that we do. It's clear from being up here that nonprofit news is still one of the most interesting and innovative parts of the news business. A lot of people are researching it. A lot of the people in the program that I'm in are also very interested in nonprofit news.
And Karen, you as a co-founder of The Lens would be in an excellent position to explain why you chose to do a nonprofit in the first place.
When we started The Lens, there were very few news nonprofits. It was sort of 9 years ago, or even maybe 10 years ago, when we really started researching. And I jokingly said at the time that it was a good time to start because there had been very few colossal failures. And people were very concerned about the state of for-profit media, and it just seemed like I was then in my 50s, and I figured I wasn't going to live long enough to see profitability, so a nonprofit model seemed the best way to go.
What should news consumers remember about the differences between nonprofit and for-profit news media?
Well, I think one of the big differences between nonprofit and commercial media is that many commercial media still rely on advertising to pay the bills. And so content is a method of getting people to look at their site or maybe their newsletters, and then they sell that to advertisers. There's been a lot more interest as the advertising business has dropped. More and more people are interested in subscribers. And everyone, the people who are researching this and the people in the business all agree that when you have when you focus on subscribers and readers rather than audience, it changes what you do. So that's what commercial media is doing. And I would say that in the nonprofit world, we've been doing that all along. We ask people directly for their support. We have foundations that fund some of our work, but we have never had this sort of three-legged stool where we're trying to work with advertisers and interest them in our product and then get people to read the stories. We're just directly doing stories that we think people want.
For disclaimer purposes, I will say now that I, over the course of almost 30 years, shudder to think, in the news business, have worked primarily for commercial organizations, from Fox 8 New Orleans all the way back to WLBT in Jackson, with a brief 11-year stop in the cable news business in between. And I can certainly observe that commercial media have an amazing reach that, in terms of the size of their consistent audience, that I don't know if there's any nonprofit entity besides public broadcasting in total that can come close to that breadth of audience. Steve, do you find that is a challenge for nonprofit news organizations, and how might that be met?
That is, I think that's really the biggest challenge. When you start as a new entity, and any entity, you have to build your audience from the ground up. Most of the commercial outlets have been going for years, and you're right, they do have vast, vast reach. I think that one of the ways they get such wide reach is that they offer something for everyone. And when you are a nonprofit like ours, we decide to focus on certain things that we believe are being underserved and certain subjects we think aren't getting the right coverage in commercial media. And so we target those things. I think that there is a much greater audience than we currently have for this, but we do have to aggressively find those people who are interested in our work. I mean, one of the things I say is that, you know, our audience at The Lens is probably not going to be the person who subscribed to the Picayune and they found some City Hall news on the way to the sports section. You know, our readers, our supporters are not going to be people who accidentally come across public interest news. They're already in the mode where they're looking for that.
You mean it's not come for the funny pages and stay for the corruption?
Exactly. I mean, that sort of bundling that was the approach of the newspaper from before, I mean, that's just not really working. People are going directly to sites that make them laugh, and then they're going to directly to places and sources of information that inform them about these things. So I really don't think that works anymore. So you're right, Tom, that it is hard to build that audience. But I also think that there is a large audience for this kind of work. Maybe not as large as the audience for the Saints, for instance, but that's okay because we don't need that in order to do the kind of work we need.
Karen, you're engaged very directly in just what we're talking about here, not only building the audience, but also finding the support for the work that we do here at The Lens. What are your thoughts on those challenges?
Well, interestingly enough, I was approached by someone from not New Orleans, from Louisiana, but another city in Louisiana, who has a for-profit media entity that they'd like to convert to nonprofit. And they asked to get together with me this week, and I plan on doing that. It just shows to me that even an established for-profit outlet is scrambling, and you know, like an open bar at a wedding, everyone's pushing their way forward to the bar. And I have seen recently that there are more and more for-profit entities, not converting to nonprofit, but angling for the same pool of funds that we have traditionally sought. So there's competition because, like you said, the for-profit entities have the broader reach and the larger audience captive in some ways, but haven't been investing so much in the kind of work we do, which is very time-consuming and has a high cost associated with it. And so therefore, there's this sort of scramble for for-profit entities to get into the nonprofit funding pool it's something worth paying attention to. I mean, I don't know if Steve could address that in terms of what they're talking about where he is up in the ivory towers, but it's something we feel acutely here as we're putting together our 2019 budget.
I have observed that some commercial media are competing for nonprofit funds, and that's concerned me. Actually, just last week, I was speaking with someone who's in the foundation world, and she was telling me that she understands that, but she thinks that because foundations are still predisposed to give to nonprofits, and you know they don't generally want to pay the there's a penalty for giving to for profits. She thinks that is a lower risk. I'm still concerned about it because I've seen different news outlets, you know, seek grant funding or sort of seek foundation funding to do some of the similar work that we do. So I am concerned about it, as Karen is. But I also think that there's a big change in the sort of mentality of going and doing grant-funded public interest reporting. It's not as easy as filling out some grant application and sending it off. You really have to sort of align your whole organization around this work. And so we've done that. And I think that, you know, existing nonprofits are sort of at an advantage for that sort of thing. I will also like to mention that, you know, when you're sort of making your appeals directly to readers and you're doing public interest work, I continue to be amazed when I meet people and they tell me that they know of The Lens and they have this fierce loyalty to the organization. I feel like that's directly related to us being a nonprofit. I know that people like, you know, they have their own favorite media outlets in general, but there's something about the Lens being a nonprofit investigative public interest outlet that people really identify with and they really want to support. And so I think that comes along with being a nonprofit.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've pioneered a lot of community engagement that was not common. I mean, I jokingly tell people that before Katrina, you couldn't find an email address for any of the news outlets to save your life and contact information. And whereas we've always been freely open to engaging with our audience in one-on-one and also with community interest events. So I think our relationship is actually longstanding, and we try and get out there as much as we can.
Steve, I'll ask you and turn to Karen as well for this. Do you find that is the nature of nonprofit news, does that lend itself to those organizations being more willing to adapt, say, new technologies or new media in that effort for that scramble for subscribers, if you will?
Well, I do think that because we started from scratch, we didn't have any legacy product to think about, and so we were developing things as we went, and all the tools and the most interesting things that were going on were online, and so that's, you know, where we went. Even before I got here, the Lens was innovating in terms of how it covered news. You know, back when no one was doing, you know, much in the way of live coverage on Twitter. You know, everyone at the Lens was doing that. And I observed that from Florida, where I was living. So I do think it's an aspect of being a startup, you know, when the Lens originally started, and that we are more nimble and we're able to shift. It's true that we don't have as many resources, but when we decide to go do something, we don't have to put it through layers of management. We can just decide to go off and do it.
And on the technological front, Karen, I know you're involved a large way with the Inside the Lens page on mm-hmm. Facebook. Tell me about that and why that was an interesting outlet for what we do here.
Well, one of the things we have to accept is that a lot of people get a lot of their information on Facebook. And so, you know, there could be a whole other discussion about what that means. But the reality is that's where a lot of people spend a lot of time. And it's a sort of easy place to communicate with people. And so one of the things is that we can't always cover everything we want to cover. But we do a lot of interesting things, and we encounter a lot of interesting things while doing the other work that we do. So Inside the Lens was a way of bringing more of our the sort of random bits of information that we collect during the course of a week and putting it out there for people to see. I do a lot of posting of agendas and different sort of land use issues that people find interesting. People are very active. I mean, it's an interesting sort of spot to see how, passionate people feel about height restrictions, for instance.
Right, right.
So we hope to expand that and continue to put pieces and bits of information as we get them that show people that we are, you know, sometimes take our nose out of the spreadsheets.
I hope that's not a critical observation on people like me who use a lot of spreadsheets, my friend. I'm not sure what you mean by that remark. I will note that listening to Karen reminds me of a conversation I had with some colleagues in Mississippi not too long ago about engagement, and I made the observation at the time that as they were discussing the time they spent actually conversing with their audience in terms of responding to comments on Twitter or Facebook frankly just talking with people on the phone who might call in. In a lot of newsrooms, and I won't cite any examples of this, but in a lot of commercial newsrooms, the idea that you would spend time interacting directly with your audience is horrifying to a lot of people in that commercial setting. And I would cite, certainly the deadline pressures that we all face, but also the much different culture of, for instance, a broadcaster that is used to that one-way conversation.
Exactly. I think you've made a great point. It's that it's considered something that's in addition to all the other work that you have to do. And I understand that. I've been in that position where I got calls as a reporter for a newspaper, and it seemed like this is diverting me from the job that I needed to do, which is to write another story. But as you sort of come to understand it, that actually is the work that we do. And yes, it might interrupt something else that you're doing, but when you get a call from someone asking you something, I mean, this is direct. This is a request for help. And this is exactly the sort of thing that we should do to respond to that. And we get calls like that all the time. I know Marta gets the most covering the schools in the city. And we deal with those directly. And that is just, that's something that we do. So I do think we approach that differently. I think Karen has always approached that differently, that this is not an interruption. It's part of what we do.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to give TV and radio their due. And I will say that there are some things that these commercial broadcasters and newspapers as well do very well. The thought of severe weather coverage comes to mind immediately. In terms of the outlook, the year ahead, Karen, I'll address this with you first. What will the Lens be engaged in terms of new initiatives and new ways of doing business for the people we serve?
Well, I mean, we have been working on our cultural economy reporting. Michael's been doing that. And I know Carrie's coming up with some stories about lead. It's an issue that's...
Carrie Nix, mm-hmm, staff Carrie Nix.
And Marta will continue her school's reporting. We'd also looking forward to and working behind the scenes at getting back into the criminal justice issues that we started and have been known for in the past. I think it's sort of never ending, but it certainly seems never ending in terms of potential stories. So there's that. And then just sort of rethinking how we reach and engage our audience. This is our year end, which is, if you listen to the radio, you understand a lot of year end funding appeals taking place this time of year. We're pretty focused on that right now because we'd like, I didn't come from a background in philanthropy. We bought our newspapers and we bought a lot of them. But it would never occur to me to throw $10 to a news outlet. And I've since changed my mind about that. And I'm hoping I can change other folks' minds about it, too. I'm really trying to double down on connecting with people who may have, forgotten about us to remind them we're still here. And looking forward to 2019. I think we've had, the Lens exists in a sort of dog years kind of lifespan where we've seen the ups and downs of the business in a pretty quick succession of years. And so that's why, we let Steve go up there so he could bring back all the wisdom.
Right. Steve, I'll leave you with the final word. What's your outlook for the nonprofit news industry in general, not just locally, but on the grander scale? What should we expect? What does nonprofit news need to do in the year ahead to accomplish its mission?
It's exactly what we talked about in terms of growing audience and demonstrating our value. In terms of how we do it differently, I'm eager to try to build upon the great success we had with those public records workshops and doing more kinds of training and direct outreach and meeting with the community members. There's a lot more of that could be done. And the feedback that we got from the community was I was kind of surprised by it and gratified to hear that people found it so valuable. So that's it sounds different that a news site would be, you know, be focusing on doing these kinds of trainings, but that's because we think that it's all part of the news business, and that, you know, informed citizens who are out there asking questions of their government officials, this is all part of you know, creating a functional, accountable government. So investigative news is one part. Active citizens and readers is another part. We hope that those people become members and support our work. And these things continue in a virtuous cycle. So they all kind of fit together in the way I see it.
Steve Myers, Nieman Fellow of The Lens, and Karen Gabois, co-founder of The Lens. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Take care.
A reminder before we go. If you'd like to support The Lens this year, and we hope you do, you have just a few days left to take advantage of a special matching gift campaign. Newsmatch will match your new monthly donation each month of next year, or they will double your one-time gift, all up to $1,000. But you'll need to donate by December 31st. Please give today and support your nonprofit news team. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind The Lens.